Lyle Larson in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we hear a perspective on the end of the war in Afghanistan from a former NPR journalist who covered the fall of the Taliban and went on to live in the country for the better part of 10 years. That's coming up in just a little bit. First, do you have a favorite quote, one that means a lot to you for some reason? Maybe it's become sort of a personal motto. Maybe you really admire the person who said it and appreciate the circumstances under which it was first said. Or maybe it's just funny, witty, and easy to go to. If it's a well-known quote, odds are you'll find it in the new Yale Book of Quotations. It's an update from the 2006 edition, which came out this week. Among the 12,000-plus entries include Shakespeare, Oscar Wilde, Donald Trump, and some Wisconsinites like astronaut James Lovell.
Houston, we've had a problem.
And we want to know which quotes speak to you at 800-642-1234. Is there a well-known saying or expression that you particularly enjoy? Any that you find motivating or help you stay on track? Maybe you've got a quote from a friend or family member that resonates with you. We want to hear it. Call in now, 800-642-1234, and you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Fred Shapiro is the Associate Director for Collections and Special Projects at the Yale Law School Library. He's also the editor of the new Yale Book of Quotations, as well as the book's original release. Fred, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So can you talk just a little bit about the origins of the 2006 edition of this book and how you got into quotations?
When I was 10 years old, my father brought back a copy of Bartlett's Quotations from a used bookstore. And I really enjoyed browsing through it, learning about history and literature and culture from the quotations. And I kept that interest. And eventually, a publisher asked me if I wanted to do a reference book for them. And I said, yes, definitely, a book of quotations. The rest is history.
Can you tell me one of those early quotations from the Bartlett's book that stood out to you, that you kept with you over the years?
People ask me about my favorite quotations, and it's like a favorite child. I know too many of them I have too many swimming in my head to focus on one.
Sure.
One quote, which is a nice one, is by a French writer, André Gide. He said, "Believe those who are seeking the truth, doubt those who find it."
And why has that stood out to you?
It's saying something which I think is true. It's saying it in an eloquent way, and it's provocative. It gives you something to think about.
Of course, we are talking to Fred Shapiro right now, Associate Director for Collections and Special Projects at the Yale Law School Library. He's also the editor of the new Yale Book of Quotations. That's an update from the 2006 edition, and we're taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. So, Fred, to you, what makes a quote, quote, worthy?
Well, I mean, my main criterion is famousness. If it's something that is known by millions of people, that is quoted all the time, if you do a Google search, it comes up with oodles of hits. That's my main criterion for including it in the book. But I also look for quotes that are maybe not world famous, but are very eloquent or very funny. And also quotes that are historically important. The Emancipation Proclamation by Abraham Lincoln is a quote which had tremendous historic impact and freed the slaves.
Now, Fred, I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Scott in Madison. Hi, Scott.
Hey, afternoon. My quote would be from J. Edgar Hoover in a meeting after the Chicago Police Department was given a good kill on the murder of Fred Hampton. And Mr. Hoover was asked by one of the other members of the group that was there, was justice served? And to answer that, Mr. Hoover said, justice is an obstacle to law and order.
Scott,
I've heard that one before.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, and Fred, what do you think of that? How does that resonate to you, I guess, in a historical way?
Well, you know, part of what makes a great quote is if it comes from someone who is very well known, an interesting figure, whether for good or bad. J. Edgar Hoover was certainly that, and it, you know, it tells you a lot about him, about his way of thinking and his values.
Thank you again for that call, Scott. I want to go back to our callers because a lot of people have quotes they want to share. We have Patricia in Manitowoc. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. I have a lot of them that I like, especially from my family members, but I'm going to go with one from the writer Maya Angelou. When people tell you who they are, believe them.
And Patricia, why does that quote stick out to you?
Well, because, you know, we all say things. We say we're going to do this and do that. But it kind of goes back to actions speak louder than words.
Patricia, thank you so much for that quote. So Patricia points to that really famous Maya Angelou quote, you know, when people tell you who they are, believe them. Does this show up in your book?
No, I do have a number of quotes by Maya Angelou, who was pretty quotable, but I didn't have that one. But that's a good one. Maybe the next edition I should include it.
And so, Fred, you know, there are so many quotes. They float around so much. Why do you think quotes are important to us? What do quotes tell us about ourselves?
Well, you know, first of all, we live in a society now where people are more interested than ever in the snippet, the catchphrase, the short, pithy expression of ideas. Fewer people have the time now or the patience to sit through a long text. They're looking for something that's quick and catchy. And we have so much of our culture now is communicated through internet memes, through sound bites that we see on television, that you know, a short quote is exactly what people find useful and what gives them a quick charge of interest and excitement.
We are talking about famous quotes right now with Fred Shapiro. He's the Associate Director for Collections and Special Projects at the Yale Law School Library. He's also the editor of the new Yale Book of Quotations. And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite well-known quote and why? Maybe there's a saying from a friend or family member that has stuck with you throughout the years. We want to hear it. Call in now, 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we'll pick up this conversation in just a moment right here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Thanks for being with us. We're talking about famous quotes right now. The new Yale Book of Quotations came out on Tuesday, and it's an update on the 2006 edition. The book contains 12,000 1,000 comments, quips, and expressions from everything from literature, pop culture, sports, politics, and more. Fred Shapiro edited both of those books, and he is the Associate Director for Collections and Special Projects at the Yale Law School Library, and he stays with us now. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Share your favorite quote with us and what it means to you. Again, the number 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And I'm going to go back to our callers right now. We have Michael in Appleton. Hi, Michael.
Hey.
What did you want to bring up, Michael?
I'm calling with a quote, but it's not actually a favorite quote. It's just one that I wanted to sort of bring up. And it's the ends justify the means, and Machiavelli. And the reason I bring it up is just that almost exclusively when people say it, they're A, trying to justify something bad, and generally misunderstanding and misapplying it, and don't really acknowledge the fact that it shouldn't really be seen as a good thing that you're saying the ends justify the means.
And Michael, is that one of those phrases that when you hear people use it, that maybe it like kind of gets on your nerves a little bit when they seem to be using it incorrectly?
And it's not even incorrectly. It's just that the people who have a tendency to use it in justification of their actions are generally sort of smarmy and often not very great people.
Michael, well, thank you so much for sharing that. And Fred, I'm going to turn back to you because we hear that phrase, the ends justify the means, a lot, and it's shorthand. And we were just talking a little bit about why people do rely on quotes like that to get to the point really fast. Do you hear frequently quotes either misapplied or misused kind of just in general day-to-day conversations?
Sure, all the time. It's disturbing to hear that people are using the end justifies the means, using that phrase as if they agree with it. The point of the quote is to say to someone else, "Oh, you're saying that the end justifies the means," meaning that you're doing something wrong, that you're doing something inappropriate. If people think that's a great quote, then that's kind of scary, that they're embracing a kind of immorality and devil-may-care attitude.
And Michael, thank you again for that call. Oh, Fred, were you about to say something?
So there are many quotes that really are misunderstood, like the exception proves the rule. People use that quote thinking that because there's an exception to a rule, then that proves that the rule is correct, which is not what the quote means. The quote was originally used to mean a legal kind of expression, where if you see a sign saying keep off the grass on Sundays, that implies that you can go on the grass on every other day. So the very fact that someone is saying there's an exception is telling you that there is a rule, but people rarely use that one correctly.
And Fred, I'll have to admit, I think I am guilty of using that quote incorrectly. We are talking to Fred Shapiro right now, Associate Director for Collections and Special Projects at the Yale Law School Library. He's the editor of the new Yale Book of Quotations, which just got a refresh from the 2006 edition. And I'm going to go back to our callers right now. We have Donna in Brookfield. Hi, Donna.
Hi, good to talk to you this afternoon. Well, I do have a favorite quote. It's actually like an African proverb, I believe. And it means so much to me that it's even my tagline underneath my email signature. And it's that it takes a village. And I'm a middle school teacher, and I just want parents to know that, hey, we're in this together. I know this isn't an easy age, but we're in this together, and we're going to get your kid to where they need to be.
And Donna, do you have parents respond to that at all ever when they see it in your email signature?
I do. I do sometimes. They'll say, you know what? You really live by those words. They'll tell me. And I say, I try to. I do.
Well, Donna, thank you so much for sharing that and for being a teacher. Now, Fred, we just heard about that proverb. It takes a village. And how it resonates not just with Donna but with parents. Do quotes do that as like an equalizer sometimes, that people can kind of get a sense of who the other person is when they use something like that?
Yes, and you know, quotations are establish a kind of a bond between the people that use them and the people that understand them and hear them. One person says something and other people say, oh, yes, that is true. Some of these quotes are what are called proverbs. And proverbs are basic kinds of statements of the human condition that a lot of people can respond to. And in my book, I include all the well-known proverbs. And, you know, what I do in my book, which is different from most other quote books, is I try to trace each quote to its origins and give its history. For example, it takes a village to raise a child. Now, that's often referred to as a African proverb or a West African proverb. But you know, if you look in my book, it will tell you that no African proverb saying that has ever been actually discovered, but that the earliest use of it that I was able to find was by a very famous writer, Toni Morrison, who used it in 1981 in an article in Essence magazine. She said, I don't think one parent can raise a child. I don't think two parents can raise a child. You really need the whole village.
Thank you for that. That is really shining a light on a quote that we see a fair amount, Fred. Now, I want to go. We have a lot of people who want to share their favorites. I want to go to Gwen in Madison. Hi, Gwen.
Hello. My favorite quote is not nearly as profound as other people. It's from Mae West. And she is quoted as saying, you only live once, but if you do it right, once is enough. And I love that because it shows a joy for living.
Yeah. And Gwen, do you find yourself going back to that quote every once in a while? Or is it just something that is kind of a mantra for you at this point?
It just makes me smile.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Gwen. That's super fun. Now, Fred, Mae West, I feel like, gets quoted a lot. You know, famous actor from the early 20th century, mid to early 20th century. You know, why is she such a cultural touchstone?
I have a big Mae West section in my book. I have 24 quotes from Mae West in my book. And, well, you know, she was a very colorful figure. People nowadays don't realize that she was a very talented person, multi-talented person, that she wrote plays. She was not just an actress. And you know, some of her quotes have become quite famous, like, why don't you come up and see me sometime? Is that a gun in your pocket, or are you just glad to see me? In one of her films, a judge says to her character, are you trying to show contempt for the court? So she says, no, I'm doing my best to conceal it. She said, I keep a diary and someday it'll keep you. So, I mean, I could go on, but she's one of the top quote people from the 20th century.
Well, what's interesting about what Donna just said was that, you know, it was you know, it might not be profound, but it sticks with her, which I feel like is a profound thing. Even if it's a little sillier or it sounds funny, like those humorous quotes can really stick with people. And I want to talk about another humorist right now, being brought up by Keith in Forest County. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Yeah. One of my favorite people to quote is Oscar Wilde. And one I like perhaps most of all from him is, be yourself. Everyone else is taken.
And Keith, why does that stick out to you?
Well, it is so absurdly obvious, of course. and indeed, if one looks at the life of Oscar Wilde as a gay man back in the UK when it was illegal to be so, ironically, so often, he could not be himself for fear of the law in Great Britain at that time.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for sharing that. Oscar Wilde is another example of, those literary writers who have made a really big impact when it comes to quotes outside of just their literary work. Can you talk a little bit about Oscar Wilde in your book?
Yeah. All right. Now here. All right. So up to now, maybe I've been the good guy and people say, oh, he's telling us all these wonderful quotes. But I have to be kind of the bad guy now, that there are a lot of phony quotes that are out there. And this, to me, is a big issue because we're living in an age, as we all know, of where there's a lot of misinformation being spread about. Okay, so Oscar Wilde never said that. It's not something he would have said. It's more of a modern kind of quote than something that from Oscar Wilde's era. But it is always attributed to him. But in my book, I make the effort to separate the quotes that people really said from the ones they didn't. And it's still a great quote. Even if Oscar Wilde never said it, it's a fine quote that people can enjoy. But he did not actually say that. He's like the I have a huge section of Oscar Wilde in my book. He's the English Mark Twain, where he's tremendously quotable. A lot of his real quotes are wonderful, but he also attracts a lot of misquotes, misattributions.
Well, Fred, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. This was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. It was fun to me, too.
Fred Shapiro is Associate Director for Collections and Special Projects at the Yale Law School Library. He's also the editor of the new Yale Book of Quotations, which came out this week. We talked with him about famous quotes and what makes a quote memorable. Coming up after the news, we talked to journalist Sarah Chase about Afghanistan. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show, Milwaukee Common Council President Cavalier Johnson will become the interim mayor of the city after current mayor Tom Barrett steps down to take an ambassador position. Host Molly Stentz talks to Johnson about his new role and his plans to run for the permanent position. That's tomorrow morning after 7:30 on the Ideas Network. Now, the U.S. officially closed the books on its two-decade military mission in Afghanistan at the beginning of this week. There are many questions as to what happens next as the Taliban looks to form a government, acquire vital aid from the international community, and defend against the Islamic State. There's also the immediate impacts of thousands of Afghan refugees arriving and resettling in America and around the world, including Wisconsin. We're going to get a perspective on the U.S. war in Afghanistan from someone who covered it as a journalist, who advised military leaders on it, and spent nearly a decade living in the country. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Have you ever lived, traveled, or served in Afghanistan? What has been your perspective on what has been happening in Afghanistan over the last few weeks. What questions do you have about what we've seen? Call now, 800-642-1234. Again, that number is 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Chase is the author of On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. She's a former international reporter for NPR. She covered the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan, then remained living in the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar for nearly a decade. From 2009 to 2011, she advised two commanders of the international military forces in the country and also advised the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be with you, although the circumstances are not pleasurable.
Well, let's talk about those circumstances since, you know, you have been steeped in Afghanistan for many years at this point. What has been your reaction to what we've seen over the last, you know, few weeks?
I mean, heartsick. And at the same time, I knew this day was coming. I knew it about a decade ago. And that's when I really stopped working on and in Afghanistan, because the United States had decided to not address the two issues that were decisive, as far as I was concerned. And by that time, I was working for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I was in on those decisions. I knew they were definitive. And I knew there was then nothing further that I could do to stave off what we've just seen. We can talk about what those two things were, if that would be helpful.
Yeah, because I did want to ask, because I know you've said in the past, like, that the Taliban would basically be back. And so, yeah, let's talk about those two circumstances, because we want to get a really broad picture of what we're seeing.
Yeah. And what's interesting is they're not military. Mm-hmm. Both of these issues are civilian issues. The first one was the absolute in-your-face abusive corruption of the Afghan government that we were supporting. And I have to say that the way that we conducted ourselves, we meaning the United States and, you know, the rest of the international community that we were leading there, we were conducting ourselves in such a way as to select for the most corrupt individuals and practices among our Afghan counterparts. And that means, for example, there would be the militia that belonged to a kind of strongman governor that would be pulling security around the U.S. base, and they would not permit inside the base to bid on contracts anyone other than, you know, their people. So they got their kind of network, got all of the development and reconstruction contracts in that context. For example, you had every government official, be it a police officer, be it a clerk in an administrative building, be it, you know, a teacher or a doctor, every one of them was shaking down Afghan civilians. And when I would raise these issues, Westerners would tell me, oh, you know, that's just part of their culture. You shouldn't impose Western culture on them. And yet Afghans were coming to me, you know, just almost beside themselves. They said, how are you tolerating officials like this who are treating us this way? And I had the hardest time trying to bridge those two perceptions, a kind of prejudiced American perception of Afghans that, oh, they're just used to corruption, that's part of their culture. And Afghans saying, but you Americans were supposed to bring the rule of law. What's going on here? So that was one issue. And the second really important issue that I think a lot of Americans don't quite understand is the role of the Pakistani government. We keep hearing, and I have to say, I read it in the New York Times no less than a week ago, or no more than a week ago, that the Taliban emerged around the city of Kandahar. Well, I lived in the city of Kandahar for a decade, and I have talked to countless people about this, and they're unanimously, they're, what they tell me, what they told me, is that it was the Pakistani military government that basically concocted the Taliban in madrasas that were set up along the border, that were financed also by Saudi Arabia in the early 1990s. And in fact, if you look geographically at the cities that the Taliban took back then, back in 1994, the first city they took was the city of Spinboldak, which is on the border with Pakistan. Kandahar is an hour and a half drive inland. So if the Taliban had emerged around Kandahar, why wouldn't Kandahar have fallen first? It's just geographically impossible, that story. So that's what we have to understand, is that the Pakistani military intelligence agency was behind the Taliban in the first place. I then saw them reconstituting the Taliban beginning in 2003. Hmm. In the meantime, let's just remember, Osama bin Laden was living with the Taliban in Kandahar, an hour away from the Pakistani border, right? So they, you know, the Pakistani military intelligence agency, called the ISI, so I can shorten that now. The ISI really had Osama bin Laden under its wing. And oh, by the way, where did the United States find him in 2011? Why? Inside Pakistan, and not just inside Pakistan, but inside a garrison city in Pakistan. So, and in the meantime, the Pakistani government had provided nuclear technology to North Korea and to Iran. So my question is, how is it that we have maintained this alliance with Pakistan for so long? How is it that we couldn't look those facts in the face and realize that this country is hostile to us? And we shouldn't be providing $1 billion a year in military assistance to this country. So these are the two issues that needed to get dealt with, Afghan government corruption and our roles basically enabling and reinforcing it, and the role of the Pakistani military government. And both of those were not military issues. They were not issues that our soldiers could address. And so I really put them at the door of the senior civilian officials across four administrations.
Go ahead.
Just that.
We're talking to Sarah Chase right now. She's a former journalist. She used to cover international affairs for NPR. She's an author and a former military advisor. She also lived in Afghanistan. We are talking about her recollections of the country, certainly in the wake of the last couple of weeks. Now, let's stick with the Taliban for just a moment here, because we've talked now about the Pakistani military government's role in its establishment. And I feel as though I read somewhere that the Taliban was something that was almost workshopped, that they had sort of like a marketing bent in its establishment. Am I correct there, or did I misinterpret that?
Louise, JC, it was, I spoke to people in those villages around Kandahar where the Taliban had supposedly emerged. And they said that people came basically test marketing the name Taliban and the kind of cover story, which is, oh, they just want to calm down the violent chaos. It's true that Afghanistan was in a situation of violent chaos in the wake of the Soviet withdrawal mm-hmm. in 1989. And so people were pretty desperate. And what the, you know, Pakistani envoys were saying was, what if some religious students were to come and, you know, at least take these warlords' chains from across the roads and stop them from shaking you down all the time? And that was a powerful message at the time. At the time, what Taliban meant was the young apprentices who would sit at the feet of village religious leaders and study the Quran and study, you know, the religious teachings. And they were very sober, they were very quiet, and they were poor. It was almost like, you know, Franciscan friars. They basically lived off of the gifts of food that the villagers gave them. And so that is what was in people's minds when they heard the word Taliban. And in fact, I even was friends with one of the most senior Mujahideen commanders who had driven the Soviets out of southern Afghanistan in the late 1980s. And he confessed, he said, Sarah, I couldn't control my own men. And so when, you know, these people came with that message, well, I mean, it sounded good to me. I was at my wit's end. And of course, he regretted it afterwards, but he admitted that he had fallen for this, you know, marketing campaign, as mm-hmm. you just said. And that was, you know, so I was getting these accounts from very, very different people from different angles. I was getting them from villagers on the ground. I was getting them from people who lived in Quetta, Pakistan at the time. And I was getting them from senior figures like this commander, Mullah Naqib. And that's really how it happened.
We're talking with journalist, author, and former military advisor and resident of Afghanistan, Sarah Chase. We're talking about her reflections on the end of the war in Afghanistan. And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have? What observations have you made over the last couple of weeks or even over the last 20 years since the United States has been there? Again, the number is 800-642-1234. And we will continue this conversation in just a moment, right here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation with Sarah Chase, author of the book on corruption in America and what is at stake. And we are talking to her about her reflections on the end of the war in Afghanistan. She worked and lived in Afghanistan for many years, covering the fall of the Taliban 2 decades ago for NPR. Now, Sarah, just a moment ago, we were talking about the instability that happened in Afghanistan after the Soviet Union pulled out. And right now, 20 years after the fact of, America arriving in Afghanistan, could we see a similar power vacuum occur?
Well, what I want to say actually is I'd like to draw our attention to the parallel mm-hmm. between the way the Taliban moved into Afghanistan in 1994, basically by negotiation, you know, through intermediaries with these warlords. Ironically, one of the main intermediaries was none other than Hamid Karzai, the man that the United States chose to be the very first president of the post-Taliban Afghanistan. When I found that out, my jaw dropped. I was like, wait a second. The guy who brought the Taliban into Afghanistan in the first place is the guy we choose to be the first post-Taliban president. It made me go cross-eyed.
Well, do we have a sense of why we went to him?
I mean, I have my thoughts. I think it has to do with a CIA connection because the CIA had been really running the U.S. support for the Mujahideen against the Soviets, and Hamid Karzai had been an important intermediary there. And frankly, all of that support was funneled through the Pakistani Military Intelligence Agency. But I'd like to go back to the parallel. Sure. And what I want to say is that the rapid fall of these provinces and then the whole Afghan military over the past just couple of weeks is almost identical to what happened in 1994, the same kind of negotiating process that the U.S. seems to not have known about. The U.S. was negotiating in Doha, in Qatar, but the other important negotiations were happening on the ground. And I just today reached a dear friend of mine in Kandahar, and I asked him about that. I said, and he's living in hiding now, so he moves around every night. And he said, of course, I asked, did you see these negotiations going on? He said the whole world knew about it. And then he said, we were sold out. And that was painful to hear. And it's just almost a repeat of what had happened in 1994. Now, to turn to what you just asked, I'm gonna take a little bit of a tangent here. You asked about the stability of the future Taliban government. So let me say two things. The first is they don't have qualified personnel to run a government they have been very successful in running an insurgency. They've had a lot of Pakistani help with that. But the Pakistani Military Intelligence Agency is not a governing organization. And so you can see now in the appeals by both Taliban leaders and Pakistani officials, oh, the civil servant should stay in place. They should go back to work. And then you'll hear Pakistani officials telling the international community how important it is to engage with the Taliban government. And the subtext there is turn the money spigots back on. And I would just urge a little bit of patience on the part of the international community. I would urge the United States and its international partners not to let a feeling of guilt or even a feeling of sympathy for ordinary Afghans to cause them to rush to engage with the Taliban government and to provide material support. That material support is unlikely to reach ordinary people. They will be waving the distress of ordinary people as the lure. But, you know, they have been watching a lot of their cousins and in-laws in the former Afghan government get exceedingly rich under, you know, under our aegis. They want some of that. And I don't think there's any indication that they will be any better at distributing, you know, development resources to ordinary people than the previous Afghan government was. And so we shouldn't fall for this. We should not be providing money and resources to this government, which is a hostile government, frankly. And as a hostile government, whatever we do, I think should include, you know, verification provisions, like we would put in with a nuclear treaty with Iran or the old nuclear treaties with the Soviet Union. There were always provisions for independent verification that the engagements were being kept. And if we're interested in women being able to live, if we're interested in people being able to leave the country freely and anything else we might be interested in, I mean, those provisions should be part of any agreement and they should be verified.
We're talking to Sarah Chase right now. She's a former international reporter for NPR, and she covered the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan and then remained living in Afghanistan for nearly a decade. I really want to quickly go to one of our callers right now, Sarah. We have Tony in Appleton. Hi, Tony.
Hello there. Hello there. Good to speak to you, Sarah. I have a question based on your experiences as the reporter and the resident of Afghanistan. You know, we went into Afghanistan in October of 2001, and the objective was fairly clear. We had Osama bin Laden. We had it was a training ground for the Al-Qaeda folks and that kind of thing. And we focused on that. I think we had a good focus on that for quite a long time. And I did not oppose that at the time. I know some people are coming out and saying, we opposed it, we opposed it. I didn't oppose that at the time. What I did oppose was this foray that ended up happening a couple of years later into Iraq. And as somebody who was there, somebody who reported and lived there, did you determine or did you see any significant difference in our military, in our attention, in how we behaved, the United States and the international community, that may have changed around that time that the Iraq event started to take off and our attention went that way?
Tony, thank you so much for that call. And Sarah, we have about a minute left. What are your thoughts on what Tony had to ask?
Brilliant question. And it was radical. And in fact, it was immediate. In other words, there was nobody home in the U.S. Embassy. There was zero attention immediately, beginning in the beginning of in early 2002. And we were all scratching our heads. Where is the United States? It wasn't until later that I learned that as early as February 2002, U.S. officials' attention was turned to Iraq. I'd like to finish, JC, since we have so little time, just with this reflection. We often hear that countries like Afghanistan under the previous government or countries in Africa or Latin America are, quote, fragile or failing states. But in fact, they're run by sophisticated networks. Those networks don't govern very well, but that's their objective. Their objective is enriching themselves, and they're incredibly good at it. And I would just invite us all to take a look at the United States over the past 20 years. Is there not a reflection of us where we have top executives in pharmaceutical companies and defense contracting companies?
Sarah, I'm sorry. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us. Sarah Chase is a former international reporter for NPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's our weekly Food Friday segment. And this time, we're talking about dishes that young adults can make when they head off to college. And it got me thinking about when I first learned how to cook. Like many young people, I was in college and I always wanted to cook, but I had no idea where to start. And it's a little bit embarrassing to admit, but the first thing I learned how to make well was stovetop popcorn. In our house, we were a microwave popcorn family since it was easy and had minimal mess. And when we did make popcorn on the stove, we inevitably always burned it. So not really an appealing prospect, but I did live with someone in my dorm who only made stovetop popcorn, and it blew my mind. So I begged them to teach me how to make it, and ultimately learning how to make that really helped me gain the confidence to sharpen my cooking skills. Now, if you think about it, popcorn, you need to be able to gauge the temperature of oil. You need to know about the volume of grains. Pro tip, a cup of uncooked popcorn is too much popcorn. And you have to have good time management skills. So tune in tomorrow for Food Friday to share your tips and your memories. Of course, you can always email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can join the conversation live by calling in. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.